This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Just to be clear, the drive in my title, the drive I will be talking about this evening, is not an automotive show on YouTube, or the cloud storage for Fios launched by Google a few years back. There's nothing queer about Google's drive. And I'm also not talking about the sci-fi comic Drive or the recent film by the same name starring Ryan Gosling. The drive I wish to talk about with you was unveiled exactly 100 years ago by Sigmund Freud. It is a crucial part of the conceptual system he called metapsychology, his theory of the functioning of the human psyche. In a way, one could say that Freud's drive is the hardware linking the body to the mind and sexuality to the unconscious. But please don't think I'm just playing with words, punning on the automotive reference the word drive has in English. Freud's language was German, and the word he used was Trieb, which has the exact same automotive reference. In fact, drive is the English cognate of Trieb. Unfortunately, however, the English standard edition of Freud's works translated Trieb with instinct, even though Freud also occasionally used the word instinct with a different meaning. As you can imagine, this has caused a serious misunderstanding of Freud's theory in Anglophone psychoanalysis. It is thanks to the work of Jean Laplanche, a Frenchman with a profound knowledge of both Freud and the German language, that the word drive is now commonly used in English for Trieb. Nevertheless, misunderstandings persist. You are probably wondering, how can it be said that the drive is queer? To answer this question, I must introduce the work of Laplanche, the theorist of psychoanalysis who was the closest reader, translator, and direct intellectual heir of Freud. I'm claiming this. Laplanche died on 6 May 2012, uncannily on the day of Freud's birth in 1856. I think of him as one who now occupies the intellectual place of Freud, someone who has renewed psychoanalysis in the spirit of Freud's invention as both an analytic method and an epistemological framework, and who challenges the institution of psychoanalysis in its many streams as radically as Freud did the human sciences about one century ago. This achievement demanded, first of all, a thorough knowledge of Freud's work and of the German language he wrote in, a knowledge Laplanche first demonstrated in the Vocabulaire de la Psychanalyse he co-authored with J.B. Pontalis, which is not a typical dictionary, but a systematic exposition and excavation of Freud's terms and concepts, and is the basic reference work in psychoanalysis in more than 20 languages. Over the course of the 10 years of research that produced the Vocabulaire in 1967, Laplanche and Pontalis found conceptual distinctions and certain terms that allowed them to refocus concepts buried in Freud's writings and forgotten from the beginning by the Freudians, such as the notions of fantasy and psychic reality. Being translators, they pointed out that Freud used the term fantasieren for fantasizing, as distinct from einbilden, imagining. While einbilden maintains the separation between reality and the imagination, unconscious fantasies, or fantasieren, disregard reality testing, and in Freud's words, quote, equate reality of thought with external reality and wishes with their fulfillment, unquote. Thus, for example, in Freud's times, hysterical fantasies were taken to be imaginary productions. But, he maintained, They were part of the hysteric's psychic reality, which is a particular form of existence not to be confused with material reality." Unquote. What emerged from their research, LaPlanche and Pontalis, was the central role of fantasy in sexuality. And this, they argued in a groundbreaking essay, Primal Fantasy, Fantasies of Origin, Origins of Fantasy, this is the specific object of psychoanalysis, the central role of fantasy in sexuality. Secondly, then, renewing the epistemological edge of Freud's metapsychology could not be achieved without an in-depth critical reading and interpretation of his texts, a project that LaPlanche later described as putting Freud to work, that is to say, using for the texts of Freud the same analytic method Freud invented for psychoanalysis and demonstrated in his case histories and analysis of literary artistic texts, from Jensen's Gradiva and Etienne Hoffman's The Sandman to Schreber's Memoir and the amazing analysis of Leonardo da Vinci's paintings. It is by putting Freud to work, using Freud's method in analyzing Freud's own texts, that LaPlanche discovered inconsistencies, contradictions, advances, and returns in the development of Freud's thought. Contradictions in his thought that also exist in the object of his that he's studying, namely the interconnection of body and mind in what in English is called the psychic apparatus, but Freud called it the seelische Apparat, the apparatus of the soul. And here we have another of the many problems of translation. The German word die Seele has both a spiritual and a cognitive connotation in German. James Strachey's standard edition translates Seele as psyche or mind, because the word soul, the cognate of Seele, has only the spiritual connection in modern English, although it is not so in colloquial American English. Nonetheless, to some, mind carries too strong a connotation of cognition, and Freud himself preferred the word psyche. Not surprisingly, the issue of translation which LaPlanche confronts throughout his reading of Freud will have a central place in his own theory. But I'll come back to this later on. And again, it is not surprising that after a lifelong immersion in Freud's thought, LaPlanche developed his own theory of sexuality from the theory of seduction that Freud claimed he had abandoned. Freud came up with the theory of seduction in the early years of his discovery of psychoanalysis, 1895 to 97, when he was working with patients diagnosed with hysteria. From their analysis, he concluded that in each case, the patient's symptoms were caused by the psychic trauma she had suffered as a child in being sexually abused by her father. Her neurotic symptoms were the outcome of repression as a defense against that psychic trauma. However, Freud never succeeded in ascertaining an actual, real event of seduction, and moreover, could not believe that so many fathers, or indeed all fathers, including his own, were perverts. So, as he wrote to Fliess in a famous letter, "I no longer believe in my neurotica," unquote. He abandoned the theory and eventually came to think that his patient's seduction fantasies, quote, were intended to cover up the autoerotic activity of the first years of childhood, unquote. This is why, in the predominant understanding of Freudian theory, except for LaPlanche, that is, it was the abandonment of the seduction theory that made possible Freud's discovery of infantile sexuality and of the Oedipus complex. An infantile sexuality, autoerotic and endogenous, that is to say, innate in the biological organism. But while Freud himself validated this understanding, he also left room for a less conventional reading by the ambiguity in his writing. In this case, the discrepancy obvious in the three essays on the theory of sexuality between the sexuality perverse and polymorphous that he describes in the first two essays and the biologically directed reproductive sexuality of the third essay. Focusing on this contradiction or ambivalence in Freud, Laplanche shows by his analysis of text spanning the whole of Freud's works, first, that Freud never really gave up the idea of a connection between sexuality, fantasy, and psychic trauma. The concern with seduction is still present in the three essays of 1905, where Freud explicitly links seduction to the maternal care of infants. I quote briefly, "The person in charge of the child, who, after all, is as a rule his mother, herself regards him with feelings that are derived from her own sexual life. She strokes him, kisses him, rocks him, and quite clearly treats him as a substitute for a complete sexual object," unquote. And again later, 10 years later, in the Wolfman's case, Freud tries to recover the pathogenic event, the scene constructed in analysis in which a patient as a baby watched the parents having sex, the so-called primal scene. But failing to establish its reality, Freud then postulates the notion of primal fantasies as phylogenetically inherited schemata derived from actual events in prehistoric times. Here are Freud's words. "All the things that are told to us today in analysis as fantasy, the seduction of children, the inflaming of sexual excitement by observing parental intercourse, the threat of castration, or rather castration itself, were once occurrences, real occurrences, in the primeval times of the human family. Children, in their fantasies, are simply filling in the gaps in individual truth with prehistoric times, the gaps called by amnesia," obviously the infantile amnesia. Laplanche is very critical of the notion of phylogenesis, as he is of any reference to inherited or endogenous sexuality. Secondly, then, he demonstrates precisely how the gaps in individual truth occur, giving rise to fantasy and sexuality. And he does so by using one of Freud's texts and one of his major conceptual tools, that is, repression, which is one of the vicissitudes or the twists and turns of the drive. He retrieves the case of Emma from the book Freud never published, The Posthumous Project for Scientific Psychology, and reanalyzes or elaborates on Freud's analysis. This case became famous some years ago in relation to the debate on false memory syndrome, which I will not rehash, but the case is important because it is the origin of Laplanche's theory of the drive. So please bear with me if you are familiar with it. Emma was a hysteric patient with a phobia. Her symptom was the fear of walking alone into a shop. Freud's analysis revealed two scenes, one that she remembered, which occurred when she was a girl of 12, shortly after puberty. The other, of which she had no memory and was only brought up by the analysis, had taken place when she was about 8 years old. In the earlier or first scene, 8-year-old Emma is buying something in a shop alone, candy probably, and the shopkeeper tries to touch her genitals through her clothes. In the second scene, at age 12, Emma walks into a boutique and sees the two salesmen laughing together. Thinking that they are laughing at her clothes, she is seized by panic and runs out of the shop. Now, the first scene has a sexual content, but only for a spectator or in the intention of the shopkeeper. On the 8-year-old girl, Laplanche remarks, it has no immediate sexual effect, produces no excitation and provokes no defense. Noting that Freud himself characterized the scene as sexual presexual. The second scene has no sexual content. It is nonviolent and seemingly harmless. But nevertheless, when reporting her memory of this scene to Freud during the analysis, the patient immediately connected her phobia with it, saying that she remembered one of the salesmen whom she had found attractive. Both events are apparently non-traumatic. So where or when did the psychic trauma that produced the neurosis originate? The child in the first scene has neither the physiological potential for sexual excitation nor the understanding of what is a sexual attack, whereas the adolescent girl in the second scene has both. She knows about sex and what a sexual attack is, and can feel sexual excitement in her body. So the memory of the first scene comes back to her by instantaneous association, that is, her clothes, and triggers in her a sexual excitation with which she cannot cope. Her defense, or her ego's defense, is to repress the memory of the first scene and in its place develop a phobia, a fear of shops. Freud himself stated, quote, "Here we have a case of a memory arousing an affect which it did not arouse as an experience, because in the meantime, the change brought about by puberty had made possible a different understanding of what was remembered," unquote. This case is typical of hysterical repression. He remarks, "A memory is repressed and only afterwards, nachträglich, will become traumatic." In retrieving Freud's model of psychic trauma, Laplanche elaborates it in several ways. Psychic trauma consists of two moments. In the first, sexuality comes from the adult other, but does not produce trauma or defense. In the second moment, the hormonal transformation of puberty makes possible a sexual response, which awakens the memory, but is not acceptable to the ego, and therefore is perceived as unpleasure. The ego represses the awakened memory, and hence the gaps in individual truth, repression, forgetting. But the repressed memory, together with its affect, does not simply disappear. It lives on in the unconscious as a mnemic trace or reminiscence. That is, a memory that remains forever cut off from its sources. It lives on in the psyche, Laplanche says, as an internal foreign body that will continue to attack the ego from within and trigger sexual excitation. That is the sexual drive. Unlike physical trauma or traumatic neurosis caused by wounds, accidents, or wars, which are produced by an influx of excitation coming to the ego from outside, in psychic trauma, the excitation comes from inside the body or the psyche, from the reminiscence. Sexuality, then, is inherently traumatic because a crucial part of it, the early memories of infantile sexuality, are repressed and continue to exist in unconscious fantasy as reminiscences. All this is part of Laplanche's first major book, titled Life and Death in Psychoanalysis, where he makes his first radical statement in 1970. Quote, "The drive, properly speaking, in the only sense faithful to Freud's discovery, is sexuality." Unquote. From Freud's pathogenic theory limited to hysteria, Laplanche elaborates a theory of sexuality as an effect of primal seduction, and later the theory of general seduction that he proposes in a book, New Foundations for Psychoanalysis. And this is like a radical gesture. Both theories hinge on the double temporality of psychic trauma that corresponds to the double temporality in human sexual development. Sexuality, LaPlanche argues, is exogenous, intersubjective, and intrusive. It comes from the other, the adult other, the other with a small o, he emphasizes, to distance his theory from Lacan's, his teacher also. Sexuality is not innate or present in the physical body at birth, but the result of a fundamental anthropological situation, which is the prematurity of the newborn human, whose life is entirely dependent on the adults who care for it. Sexuality then is implanted in the infant by the actions and psychic investments of the mother, parents, or other adults who nurse, clean, handle, and care for the child. Now, their actions and psychic investments include both conscious and unconscious sexual fantasies. As the etymology of the word infant implies, this is a being without language and initially without an ego. The infant, and I quote, is confronted by an adult world which from the beginning sends it messages suffused with sexual meanings, which are unconscious for the sender of the message, messages the child perceives as enigmatic, that is, as a to be translated, end quote. In his earlier linguistic terminology, LaPlanche describes the messages that address the infant as enigmatic signifier or signifiers without signified. But as he develops the theory of primal seduction into a theory of general seduction, his language is inflected by the terminology of communication theory, message and content for signifier and signified. And this is because he wants to emphasize that sexuality is interhuman, intersubjective, and based in human communication, even as it is a failed or missed communication. The existence of the unconscious, he insists, is a fact of human history and not a tenet of biological or linguistic metaphysics. And the reference, of course, here is to Freud and Lacan, respectively. The messages that address the infant are not only verbal, but also, or primarily, of a sensory character: sounds, gestures, facial expressions. They have no content or no meaning to the infant. But what makes them messages is the function of address which they carry, and to which the infant responds. What makes them enigmatic is not only the infant's inadequacy to decipher or translate them, but also the unconscious sexual fantasies of the adult sender, which infiltrate or compromise the messages as a noise in the communication. I'll come back to this in a moment. Once received, the untranslatable messages are retained within the infant as residues, and this is what Freud called primal repression, and constitute the first rudimentary form of the psychic apparatus, the primary process and the first nucleus of the unconscious. Much like Freud's mnemic traces, the untranslated residues or enigmatic signifiers remain active within the unconscious as internal entities, impulses, urges, inchoate wishes, unconscious fantasies. They are enigmas that the developing ego will attempt to translate and retranslate again and again at different moments of life according to the knowledges, languages, or structures of feeling available to the subject at each moment. These residues act like a splinter in the skin, LaPlanche writes, with a metaphor not dissimilar to the internal foreign object of psychic trauma, Emma's reminiscence. But Laplanche is now describing the normal, non-pathogenic process. The untranslated residues of enigmatic signifiers remain active in the unconscious like a splinter in the skin, or we might say, like a virus installed in a computer. They remain live, though undetected, and are reactivated in adult sexuality, at times in symptomatic form, as phobias, obsessions, hallucinations, as a result of psychic trauma, and at times in forms less severe, but which nonetheless the ego may find shameful or unacceptable. And from this come the conflicts, whether moral or neurotic, that we all experience in sexual life. A particularly important aspect of Laplanche's theory is that it envisions psychoanalysis as a practice of self-translation on the part of the analysand, rather than interpretation on the part of the analyst. In the analytic situation, he says, the analysand is confronted with his internal enigma, but also the enigma of the other, the analyst. Thus, the analytic transference places the subject back within the originary situation, that of the genesis of infantile sexuality. In this sense, his theory of seduction is also a theory of transference as translation. And in another radical taking of position within the psychoanalytic community, Laplanche asserts that there is such a thing as transference to the cultural, not to the analyst, to the cultural in general. The fundamental dimension of transference is a relation to the enigma of the other. And culture, in the broadest sense, is the site of an enigmatic interpolation with many voices and ears. That is to say, that cultural objects and events in the world around us can present enigmas that respond to enigmas in ourselves. They incite us to translate them, and in the process, retranslate ourselves. This to me has been an especially inspiring idea, but I must leave it for another occasion. In one of his last works entitled Gender, Sex, and the Sexual, Laplanche takes on the question of gender, and he may have been the first or the only Freudian theorist to do so. He does not have a theory of gender comparable to his theory of sexuality, but then again, sexuality and not gender is the object of psychoanalysis. He rearticulates the relation of gender and sexuality in the interplay of three terms: gender, sex, by which you mean anatomical, physiological, and the sexual. He creates the neologism le sexual, spelled with an A in French, to distinguish it from the common French term sexuel, spelled with an E, which is a generic form for that which concerns sex. He uses the German spelling of the word with the A, with the A, to mark the originality of the concept, which he takes directly from Freud's three essays on the theory of sexuality, Sexualtheorie. Further elaborating on the transmission of messages from the adults to the child, Laplanche distinguishes two codes, or carrier languages. The first one is the code of attachment, which is carried by bodily care given to the child and directly relates to the origin of the drive. In this case, communication takes place within the relation of reciprocal attachment between mother and infant, and then between children and parents. The second is what he tentatively calls the social code, through which are communicated the messages of gender assignment, for gender is an assignment within the social. But gender, too, is an enigmatic message, or a variety of messages communicated by society at large, but initially by the small social group constituted by the kinship network of each child, siblings, other members or friends of the family, and especially the parents. Laplanche maintains that the adult's own infantile sexuality is reactivated in the presence of a child. Thus, gender messages sent by the parents are conscious, preconscious, but infiltrated by their unconscious and preconscious wishes and expectations, which may be in conflict with a child's sex or medical gender assignment. In short, both in the issue of gender and in the care given to the infant's body, the parental unconscious is like the noise in the sense of communication theory that comes to perturb and to compromise the messages, unquote. At the conclusion of the essay on gender, Laplanche defines le sexual in these words, quote, infantile sexuality, the sexual, is the very object of psychoanalysis. It is drive-based and not instinctual. It functions according to a particular economic regime that seeks tension rather than the reduction of tension, and it has the fantasy object at its source and not at its endpoint, thus reversing the object relations. Unquote. I will explain this more. Now, getting back to my title, I will try to show why the drive is fundamental to the sexual and in what sense it can be said that the drive is queer. Though I am saying this, not Laplanche. It's entirely my word, not his. Then I will retrace the path Laplanche follows in outlining two economies of pleasure in human sexuality. Since the 1970s, the central theme and running thread of Laplanche's inquiry has been the notion of drive and its relation to the psychic and to the biological. The relation of the drives to sexuality and fantasy on the one hand, and on the other, to instinct and biology. The domain of instinct and biology is what Laplanche calls the vital order, the order of life and death in psychoanalysis, which he contests right in the title of his first book. He found that Freud only uses instinct rarely, but he does so in a consistent manner, very often to refer to instinct in animals. Instinct is hereditary, fixed, and adaptive. It starts with somatic tension, has a specific action and a satisfying object, hunger, thirst, and so on, and leads to a sustained relaxation of the tension. Trieb, drive, on the other hand, Freud first defines it as a stimulus or excitation rising from within the organism and acting as a constant force which maintains an incessant and unavoidable afflux of stimulation. But where the ambiguities really arise is in the origin and nature of the drive. At times, Freud uses the word Lust, German word Lust, as synonymous with Trieb. And Laplanche points out that Lust is one of the German words which concentrate a contradiction within themselves. Like the famous heimlich, unheimlich, the uncanny, but okay. Freud himself remarks on the ambiguity of this term in two footnotes in the three essays. I quote, Lust is used to describe the sensation of sexual tension as well as a feeling of satisfaction, the experience of both a need and of a gratification, unquote. This ambiguity actually becomes a contradiction in Freud's concept of the pleasure principle, which is what regulates the tension in the psychic apparatus, but we won't go into that unless you later wish to. Laplanche then concludes, Lust is sometimes synonymous, and by the way, the English cognate lust means only one thing, and that is desire, strong, and usually violent, right? Whereas in German it has two meanings. So Laplanche concludes, Lust is sometimes synonymous with drive, with libido, urge to, desire for, and the pursuit of disequilibrium. And in this case, satiety or satisfaction is never attained. And the example he gives for this is children's play, children's games, that they can go on forever. They don't want to stop. But lust also means the experience of satisfaction. Quote, lust in the sense of pleasure refers to discharge and the relaxation of tension. So, Laplanche continues, we have two radically different models of psychic functioning or of the economy of pleasure. Drive, which seeks excitation at the cost of total exhaustion, and instinct, which seeks relaxation. Unquote. How do these two forces coexist in the human psychic apparatus? In Freud, the energy of the sexual drive, libido, is held in check or opposed by what Freud called the self-preservative drives, or ego drives, which are part of the narcissism of the ego and necessary for its survival. Laplanche argues that the self-preservative function is located in what contemporary psychology calls attachment, the affectionate and reciprocal relation between mother and infant, which guarantees the survival and development of each newborn, and later between children and their parents or caretakers. Freud spoke of affection or desexualized affectionate feelings toward the parents or siblings resulting from the resolution of the Oedipus complex. But the theory of attachment based on child observation locates attachment much earlier in the reciprocal attachment between mother and infant. Attachment, and we can call it with its common name, love, emerges, quoting Laplanche, from a domain that is broadly understood as that of self-preservation and instinct. This domain also includes the instinctual sexuality connected to the maturation of the organism and involving neurohormonal relays, the complexity of which is now beginning to be recognized. As Freud had already emphasized, this sexuality pushes human beings towards sexual behaviors that are more or less pre-programmed for the self-preservation of the species. But the problem is that this sexuality, which is hormonal in origin, is absent in humans from birth to the pre-pubertal period. Unquote. And it is precisely between birth and puberty that the infantile sexuality Freud discovered is situated. That sexuality, perverse and polymorphous, Laplanche says, is indissociably connected to fantasy as its cause. Repressed, it is what constitutes the contents of the unconscious and is the very object of psychoanalysis. Laplanche calls it sexualité pulsionnelle, in English, drive sexuality, not only to distinguish it from instinctual sexuality, but also because it is not only infantile sexuality. It does not end with puberty, but continues to be active in adulthood precisely because it is mostly repressed and unconscious. The process is the same as the one Laplanche articulates in Emma's case of psychic trauma, where he concluded that sexuality is inherently traumatic because the early sexual memories being repressed continue to exist in unconscious fantasy. However, he reminds us, repression and the unconscious are not exceptional pathological phenomena, but are the lot of humanity as such. Seduction has in fact every chance of being produced within every relation of care. Before I go on, Let me briefly remark that this rather awkward term, drive sexuality, as distinct from instinctual sexuality, is a translation of the French sexualité pulsionnelle. Pulsionnelle being the adjectival form of pulsion, drive. But English has no adjective corresponding to the word drive, which is one of the reasons why the editors of the standard edition chose to translate trieb with instinct. Now, to summarize, instinctual sexuality, which is hormonal in origin, is absent in humans from birth to puberty. Drive sexuality begins long before puberty and continues to be active throughout an individual's life. So we have a problem and a paradox. The problem is that these two kinds of sexuality correspond to the two modes of functioning of drive and instinct, respectively, the pursuit of excitation, one of the meanings of lust, and the pursuit of pleasure in the object, the other meaning of lust. These are different economies of pleasure and will remain most likely difficult to reconcile in each individual's life. The paradox is that drive sexuality, which is acquired in the sense that it is implanted by the adult, precedes innate instinctual sexuality, so that when instinctual sexuality erupts in the organism at puberty, it finds its place occupied, so to speak, by the infantile drives already and always present within the unconscious. This is what Laplanche calls the too soon and too late of human sexuality. Infantile sexuality, polymorphous, perverse, paragenital, and presexual, is implanted in the infant too soon. That is, long before the human body is equipped with an instinctual sexual urge and reproductive means. Thus, when the instinct arrives at puberty, it is too late, and the place already occupied. Which does not mean that the instinct is powerless, far from it, but only that much water has passed under the bridge, leaving all sorts of residues, unconscious fantasies, neurotic symptoms, sexual peculiarities, residues with which reproductive genital sexuality will have to come to terms. Some of those residues it will manage with, and some not. In short, neurosis is normal, is the inevitable and common lot of human beings. So, the queerness of the drive. Freud opened his three essays on the theory of seer of sexuality with the question of deviance. After considering the research of sexologists in the first of the three essays, entitled The Sexual Aberrations, in the second he proposed the scandalous idea of a perverse infantile sexuality, an idea that still is or would be scandalous today if people didn't think that it isn't really sexual, or that it's just temporary, and the child will grow out of it with proper training. Laplanche has generalized Freud's theory by making deviance a condition of being human. Actually, I have argued that Freud's drive, too, is somewhat queer. In his first description, the sexual drive is described as traversing a space between bodily perceptions and mental representations, a space that is not homogeneous and not referential, that is, does not correspond to anything in the real world, but it is a heterotopic space, a space of transit and transformation. Heterotopy means displacement in position. In pathology, it is the occurrence of a tumor in a part where the elements of which it is composed do not normally exist. Samuel Delaney's novel Triton, whose protagonist is a transsexual, is subtitled An Ambiguous Heterotopia. Now, if the drive is already somewhat queer in Freud, in Laplanche it is definitely so. Freud opened the question of perverse sexuality. Laplanche theorizes drive sexuality, or the sexual, as a perverse, non-reproductive, anarchic sexuality that does not care about gender or sex and sets conditions to genital and reproductive sexuality, sets conditions to love. So let me end this long talk with an upbeat note. Just as Laplanche depathologizes Freud's seduction theory and makes seduction a common human situation, he depathologizes neurosis. We all had parents or caretakers as we came into the world. We all acquired an unconscious and were endowed with that queer drive he calls drive sexuality. And if we were lucky, we also learned how to love. Moreover, he offers the option of a very affordable psychoanalysis in his theory of transference. I'm not entirely joking. I was never psychoanalyzed, but I've been analyzing texts for many years. And every once in a while, a book, a film, or an event in the world has confronted me with the enigma of the other within me and forced me to detranslate and retranslate myself, each time in a different way. Laplanche has explained why this kind of transference happens, and not only to me. Of course, transference to the cultural takes a lot of work, but it really works. After all, no one psychoanalyzed Freud, but Freud himself.